My name is Alessandro Acquisti with Ross Bruce and George, one of the organizers of the workshop. It's a pleasure to introduce the next panel of the day on foundations. Anything from heuristics and biases to the Machiavellian brain and more. The first speaker will be Professor Dave Clark, who is a senior research scientist here at MIT at the Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Lab. And Dave.
I'm not going to use slides. It takes too long. It's a delightful title for the session. It's amazingly broad. I still don't know why I'm in that session, but no matter. I'm going to press on. By way of background, I am a computer scientist. My training was technical. I started working on the internet in the very early days, sort of around 1975 or so. For the last 10 or so years, I've become more and more interested in the issues that arise because of the embedding of the network in the larger social context. So I've been more and more interested in conversations like this that don't involve other people like me. What I am currently doing, by the last 3 years, I've been working with the National Science Foundation to help them organize a program which is called Future Internet Design, or FIND. And the challenge of this program is to invite the research community to ask itself what the global network of 15 years from now should look like. I think that a lot of network research has become somewhat incremental. How can I make the internet of today a little better? And the challenge that we've been putting to the research community is, can we have a goal-oriented vision? Can we ask what we should be doing now to build the network we want 15 years from now? I like to remind people that IPv6, which we're now squabbling over, is it a good idea, is it a bad idea, is the result of an architecture challenge which we posed in a paper that we wrote in 1991. Okay, so it is important occasionally to ask people to think about something that we should be squabbling about 15 years from now. There are a lot of reasons why I could imagine rethinking the internet. Forwarding packets is not one of them. The internet does a really great job of forwarding packets. The data plane is not what is screwed up. The thing that is at the top of my list when I think about a possibly different network is to design a network that's materially more secure. And you could ask what that means, of course. To build a network that's materially more secure, we have several fundamental problems, the first of which is we do not have an agreement of what good security is. We typically talk about security as disclosure control and integrity control and availability, but security is more than the perfection of each of those dimensions individually. In fact, as a practical matter, the security of the internet is defined as the outcome of a tussle among actors who, in many cases, have adverse interests. These are not good guys and bad guys. For example, security is privacy has to be balanced against national security, which is the right of wiretap, which is, of course, anti-privacy. And it is only through the interplay of those concerns that we will end up with a social answer. Technology will never give us a final answer here. The second issue, of course, is that we want the security of the network to be different in different places. The military is now buying COTS technology and trying to build very secure networks. There may be other parts of the world where the answers will go crazy. On the other hand, the technology seems to work the same everywhere. And the third issue, of course, is that I'm talking about a network here. I'm prepared to include in that design rules for applications. It's not just the packet layer. I would advise you, if you're going to Congress and talking to them about getting funding to try to build a more secure network, not to try to take the position that the applications are not part of the internet. Only a geek would say that. But the insecure nature of the endnode is fundamental. And so what is it that the applications or the network broadly defined can do given the fundamental insecurity of the endnodes? Clearly, we can't take on that problem, or we've bitten off far more than we can chew. So the question in this space is, can we actually reason about what it would mean to have a materially more secure network? Let me parse the problem slightly differently than we traditionally do. Instead of saying disclosure control and integrity and so forth, let me try parsing the problem along what I will call the spectrum of trust. And at one end of the spectrum of trust, you have a set of communicating parties who agree that they really trust each other. Okay. And I'm going to come back to Ross's definition of trust here. In this context, what I mean by trust is a set of parties who are assuming that they will act in each other's best interest even though they are not constrained to do so. Constraint is not the same thing as trust. Constraint is a police state. Nobody trusts anybody. So the internet's great at that end of the spectrum because what it gives you is this transparent channel between people and you can just do anything you want. When the Morris virus got loose, my telephone rang and it was my funding officer at DARPA
who was a good military officer, so he asked me the question that you should ask under those circumstances, which is, what am I supposed to tell my superior officer? And I said, tell him the internet carried out its specification perfectly, delivered the virus as fast as it could to all possible machines. And he thought for a while, and he said, you'll get away with it this time. That was 1988.
We're still getting away with it. So the point is, we're really good at delivering packets. Now, the other end of that spectrum, that trust spectrum, is where people so little trust each other, they want to have nothing to do with each other. This is the point of attack and defense.
And I'm again going back to 1975 to 1980, I remember the advice we got from the security community, which is, we'll never trust the net. So why should you embed protections in the net? Because you don't want to have protection provided to you by somebody you don't trust. So it was that every machine is its own castle with its own little drawbridge. The machines will defend themselves. The open net's great. Go crazy.
Okay? And that's what you got.
Okay. Now, in fact, although I don't have time to dwell on it, the interesting part of this spectrum is, in fact, the middle of the spectrum, which is a place we didn't think about at all in the 1970s. And that part of the spectrum is the place where people do not trust each other but wish to communicate anyway. And I think the mantra of the future is communication without trust. Most of the communication you have in the real world, unless it's so trivially insignificant that you don't really think about it, is with people that you are not committed to trusting. Okay. You go into a store, you're going to buy something from the clerk, you don't necessarily trust that clerk. You know, you give them $20, the clerk doesn't necessarily trust you, they put the $20 on the table while they make the change, so you can't claim later that it was a 50 or something like that. You have little protocols that you use so that you can carry out the transaction. If you're doing something significant like buying a house, you don't just hand somebody a big bag of money and let them hand you a piece of paper that purports to be a deed. You use trusted third parties to intermediate that transaction. The trusted third parties may not be, when we put this on the net, the trusted third parties may not be in the middle of the packet flow, but they're in the middle of the trust. And we haven't thought about what the network, either at the packet level or in terms of design patterns for trustworthy applications, should be in order to facilitate that middle region. Let me talk for a minute about the end of the spectrum, which involves open communication. What we do in that space, as I said today, is we're really good at forwarding packets. What we are not good at in that space is having a generalized theory of availability. And I want to say just a couple words about availability. The issue in that space, remember at the untrustworthy end, I said, this is where machines attack each other. Okay. And I want to be defended. Availability, in its worst case, is when you are attacked by the, when your communication, not you, but when your communication is attacked by the network. And we've known for some time that there was the potential of this. We talked about Byzantine routers, which forward pings, which forward routing packets, which forward most of your data packets, so the network can't tell they're broken. But they selectively identify certain packets of yours and zap them. And for a long time, people said, oh, Shabba, who the hell would ever do that? To which the answer is Comcast. Right? That's what they're doing, right? They're singling out the peer-to-peer packets, and they're going, bingo, bingo, bingo. Actually, they're doing much worse than that. They're injecting resets and all this kind of cool stuff. Right. This is a direct attack on availability. So how do you think about that if you're going to re-architect the network? I think there's actually a vocabulary in that space which would be very accessible to people in this room, because the way you have to think about that problem is not in terms of forwarding and routing algorithms. It has to do with control and power. Any point of indirection in the network, for example, when you translate a DNS name into an address, or when you translate address into a route, a computer scientist would call this a point of indirection, and there's an old saying in computer science, which is that there's no problem you can't solve with another indirection. And my first modification to that was accept performance. But the second modification is to point out that every point of indirection is a point of control, and when you put it into the system, you then have to fight over who controls it. Okay. So who controls the power to convert names into addresses? For example, do you have the power in the internet today to decide which DNS server you want to use? Unless you're extremely geeky, you do not have that power. And by attacking the DNS, somebody can turn around and attack your communication by directing you to a wrong place. How many of you have ever entered a URL into a browser and ended up at the wrong place? Right. everybody should raise your hand, because that's what happens sometimes. You're in a hotel or a hotspot, and you turn your browser on, you end up at a splash page that asks you to pay $9.95. We don't call that an attack, because we don't think the party is a bad guy. Okay. On the other hand, they completely subverted your communication. Okay. Should you have the power to route around that, and I don't mean route in a technical routing sense, should you have the power to have the control to be able to assure that you got to the place you wanted to get? Okay. That is, in fact, an architecture for availability which the internet never had. Okay. Now, notice my definition earlier of security. I said it's a balance among conflicting interests. And in fact, availability will, in fact, turn out to be solved as a balance among competing interests. And it is carried out using a vocabulary of control, balance of power. And this is a vocabulary which is, I think, very accessible to people in the social sciences. This is a way, I hope, of making the problem of security a little more accessible than if I came here and talked about either about encryption or about routing algorithms. Okay. I want to extend a sort of an invitation. If thinking about this as an engineering problem, this is not an empirical problem to study a network that's already built. This is an engineering problem to talk about a network that might be built and to talk about preferences, preferences for identity mechanisms, preferences for control. I would invite you to get a little interested in what the NSF is trying to do in the FIND program, but I'm out of time.
I'm just putting this thing back together. I'm being a local host here, so just introduce the next person.
I'll introduce the next speaker, who is David Livingstone Smith, professor at the University of New England. David has been doing really personal work in the philosophy of mind and the philosophy of society.
No.
That's a classic mistake.
Yeah. Right. Well, as Alessandro said, I'm a philosopher. I'm an ideas guy. I come from a different world than many of you. I don't understand most of the acronyms that have been used. And I know very little about the internet and can barely manage to operate my own computer, much less reflect on their operations generally. So when I was initially asked to attend this meeting, I thought, wow, that's really cool. That was my first thought. My second thought was, but why? I mean, has there been some mistake? What might I have to offer here? Well, I decided to say yes, because it sounded so interesting. The next step was to justify to my university that a philosopher might make some contribution to a workshop on security and human behavior, which I managed to pull off. I must say I was immensely reassured when Ross said that, well, what you're expected to do is just spend 5 or 10 minutes talking about what you're interested in. Well, I can do that. However, reassurance quickly faded when I saw elaborately prepared PowerPoint presentations, which is the kind of thing philosophers don't do, and people rushing to complete their missions within the allotted time, sometimes successfully, sometimes unsuccessfully. So, nonetheless, I'm going to take Ross at his word and talk a little bit about my interests, the research that I've done, and with specific reference to the elements which I think are of relevance to the sorts of things we've been looking at here. First of all, I'm a philosopher, but I'm not interested in the kinds of things a lot of philosophers are interested in. I'm not interested in questions like, is a chair distinct from the sum of its molecules? Which is actually quite a hot philosophical question. That sort of question is fun, and it's good mental exercise, but it's a very little practical significance, and I'm interested in things of practical significance. It's kind of like lifting weights in the gym. It has no intrinsic benefit, but ultimately it makes you stronger so you can do other things which are of benefit. I'm interested in human nature. I'm interested in what makes human beings tick, and I'm interested in the problematic aspects of human behavior and human experience and thought and affect and so on. And I think in order to address these questions meaningfully, we need to look at human beings as human animals. This is a room of primates, very peculiar primates. Primates that push buttons on little artifacts that they build to communicate with one another, that have extraordinary ornaments that deprive one another of reproductively useful information about their bodies, devices which correct deficits in their sense organs and also lend them an artificial appearance of symmetry, which we all find attractive, and so on. And the issues of security, or human behavior security, must, I think, be understood in that context. Security generally. I don't really like the term security. It's been used, and there have been somewhat baroque discussions about the relationship between security and safety. I like danger and safety. I think these are more evocative terms. I'm not quite sure there's a real coherent distinction between security and security and safety. So I'm going to be inclined to use those terms. And to understand these things, we need to not only look at our own evolutionary history, our significance as primates and as social mammals, but we need to look at nature generally. Deception, which is implied by so many of the discussions here today, is a normal feature of nature. So it's not by chance that we are, you know, we are liars. We lie to one another. We deceive one another. We lie and deceive one another because that's part of the big natural picture. Biologists have shown us quite definitively that deception runs through, it saturates the biosphere, and the reason that it does, in the right proportions, is because it works. That is, those organisms that can manipulate others' impressions of them have an edge. They have an edge in the struggle for reproductive success, which is the engine of evolution. Now, human beings, being the strange primates that we are with these hypertrophied brains and this incredible social intelligence, play very interesting and elaborate games, social games, around deception and counter-deception and often futile attempts at detection, as Paul Ekman has demonstrated through his work. I think one of the problems confronting us is that, having evolved the capacity for language some time ago, we're easily suckered by it. That is, we're too busy listening to the lyrics, and we don't listen to the melody and watch the dance. So language has actually given us thrown a monkey wrench into the sequence of adaptations that have helped us regulate one another's behavior, among lots of other things. Now, a lot of deception, we tend to talk about lying, and this is a distinctively human form of deception. It's a distinctively verbal form of deception. But a lot of deception is nonverbal. The bulk of it is nonverbal, amongst our species as well. I mean, if one were to have videos of all the conversations and interactions that took place, say, when you're getting coffee and having pastries and what's going to happen in the coffee break, you would see a lot of these very subtle games that we're so good at that we perform automatically. And a lot of it is going to be cashed out in the currency of bearing and manner and, you know, subtle indications of where we stand in the dominance hierarchy and so on and so forth. One of my favorite psychologist, I think the greatest American psychologist, Mark Twain, put his finger on this a long time ago, about a century ago. He wrote, "By examination and mathematical computation," just to appeal to the empiricists among you, "I find that the proportion of the spoken lie to the other varieties is 1 to 22,894. Therefore, the spoken lie is of no consequence, and it is not worthwhile to go around fussing about it and trying to make believe that it's an important matter." Well, of course, it is. It is of some consequence. The hyperbole was to a point. So much of deception we take for granted as just normal behavior. I mean, our clothing, cosmetics, our bearing, cosmetic surgery, so on and so forth. I was once challenged on this by an interviewer on television. I made the mistake of pointing out that her makeup was a false indication of signs of fertility, which didn't go over well. So we're not only deceivers, we're self-deceivers. Right? We have this remarkable capacity to fool ourselves. And it's very easy to see this as some sort of pathological condition. I don't think it is. I think there are a variety of reasons for thinking that self-deception has some utility. One reason for thinking that was the point initially articulated again by my man Mark Twain, who wrote in his autobiography, "When a person cannot deceive himself, the chances are against his being able to deceive other people." Now, this is a point that Paul Ekman made yesterday. It's normally associated with two sociobiologists, Robert Trivers and Richard Alexander, who independently in the 70s suggested that the function of self-deception, the adaptive function of self-deception, is to bury deception more fully from others. In other words, if you can be insincere sincerely, if you can lie fully believing in your own lie, you're liable to be a much more successful salesman. You're going to block a lot of the holes that might allow others to catch on to your deception. I think there's greater utility than that even, because through self-deception, I think we have a really remarkable means for manipulating our own behavior and for really for engineering forms of behavior which would otherwise be blocked by a set of other psychological and evolved biological constraints, and which we deploy, I think, most strikingly in war. It's through deceiving ourselves about, and this is very, very brief, I'll give the advertisement, you have to read the book to get the full story, which is my most recent book, The Most Dangerous Animals, by deceiving ourselves about the humanity of our adversaries, we can much more readily engage in the bloody business of warfare. We can exclude them from the moral community by dehumanizing them, and there are very specific patterns of self-deception that are deployed in those contexts. And at this point, I'll finish. Thank you.
Receiving in about 3 weeks.
Cambridge, Yale Cambridge University, Cambridge, yes. Tyler has been doing lots of work on the economics of information security and specifically lots of work on fish, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm. All right, well, nice. All right, that's good. Do I need to use the microphone? Okay. All right. Well, okay, so thanks for that introduction. So I'm a computer scientist by training, but my research interests have been interdisciplinary. I've been looking at the economics of security, and in particular trying to understand empirically electronic crime. I've been looking at phishing websites and the play back and forth between the attackers and defenders over the past couple of years. But today, I'm talking about something a little different, which is an idea that Ross had a while back, and is to look at some of the underlying factors which affect people's susceptibility to different types of online scams. So there's a lot of people in this room who've done important research in usability and security and have found that people do not respond to security indicators. There's at least a large proportion of people who do not do so. And what we wanted to explore was whether or not there was something inherent about the people themselves which explained why some people fall for phishing versus other people. and other kinds of attack, other kinds of deception as well. But we decided to test this in the case of phishing. So we designed a survey to test people's recognition of phishing attacks. It's not the best survey. There are people in this room who have designed better experiments. But we designed a fairly simple, quick survey. But what was different about what we did is, in addition to testing people's ability to see phishing, we also added on a test about their brain type. So we used a test from the psychologist at Cambridge called Simon Baron Cohen. He's probably perhaps better known as the cousin of Sacha Baron Cohen. But he's also perhaps the world expert on autism research. And he has a theory of the brain, which says that there are two primary types of brains, what he calls the male brain, the prototypical male and female brain. And it's broken down into systemizers, which are people who are better at understanding and building systems. And then you have empathizers, who are better at understanding the perspectives of others, someone who can walk into a room and read a situation and look at the overall perspective and take decisions that way. So we designed a quiz first to test phishing, then to test brain types. So this is what our very problematic phishing survey does. It just presents screenshots of phishing websites to people, and they judge whether they think this is a phishing website or not. And then we provided with the systemizing and empathizing tests. And these are our results. So we surveyed about 140 Cambridge students, undergraduates and graduates across all disciplines. If you look, the way to interpret these graphs are that the y-axis shows the number of responses that are correct and for the phishing test. So higher values suggest that they're better at detecting phishing. Lower values suggest they're worse. And then the x-axis shows the score for the different tests. So the SQ scores, systemizing test. So scores on the left are people who are bad at systemizing, and scores on the right are people who are good at systemizing. And likewise, you have on the right-hand side shows the empathizing scores. How do you interpret this? Well, obviously there are more factors than this at play, but it does suggest that people who are very strong empathizers do worse at phishing on average, and people who are very weak systemizers also do worse, whereas people who are strong systemizers do good at detecting phishing at a higher rate. So what's the intuition kind of behind this? Empathizers are more, like I said, are more likely to be able to come into a room and judge lots of different characteristics simultaneously, but they're less likely to hone in on a particular indicator which they have to evaluate. And if you look back at this, when someone's deciding whether this is phishing, much of this all looks very legitimate. You have to know to look in at the one point, the URL, as where it indicates that this is actually not a legitimate site, and also be able to parse that URL properly. So that's a task which we believe systemizers are inherently going to be better at doing. Yes.
Are those two factors related to one another, and are the effects additive?
There is a relationship between the two. So there's a tendency of people who are more likely to be strong systemizers to be weaker empathizers. And the simple way that we've sort of dealt with that is in the next slide, where we compute sort of the difference between the systemizing score and the empathizing score. This shows a stronger indication, where people who are have a higher scoring on the systemizing test compared to the empathizing test do much better at detecting phishing versus those who don't.
You could also examine that by putting in the other scores that is called variant in a regression model.
Yeah. There are lots of things that can be done. So this is meant to be a simple initial test to see whether or not this hypothesis has merit. And from looking at this first sample, I think it suggests that it does. So I'm more than welcome to have lots of conversations with you about how we can do better experiments, how we can do better analysis But I think the key take-home point is that we need to also be considering the inherent characteristics of people in determining susceptibility to online scams, and also how we can, from this, once we've agreed that this exists, how can we then design better systems to adapt to people who are not of the traditional type to do score well in these tests. We need to design systems to work for all different types of people. So that's sort of the long-term goal from this work.
Did you do any
discovery
on how experienced these people were with the concept?
No, we asked their subject, and so we know whether or not they had whether or not they were in a technical subject or not. But that was the extent. But thank you very much.
Okay, I thought I'd give a broader view of the psychology of judgment decision making today, just because I think it'd be helpful to have sort of a common ground or platform from which to talk. So basically, in research on behavioral decision making, there's sort of two views of human behavior. One, which draws largely on economics, is the rational agent model, which suggests that people are well-informed, they have stable preferences from one context to another, they behave self-interestedly, they're selfish and calculating. And it implies basically that if you want to figure out how a person will behave in a situation, what you want to figure out is what would maximize their utility, and you can model, if you know their preferences, you can model their behavior with a nice utility function. In contrast to that, largely from the work of Herb Simon and later colleagues, there's a view. The alternative view is more about bounded rationality, which implies that people show mediocre judgment, they have unstable preferences, they're impulsive, myopic, and at the same time both trusting and vindictive. And the guiding principle of choice here is that people satisfy. So they choose, in other words, the sort of first thing that satisfies the basic threshold of what's a good enough option for me. So although the rational choice model is a nice idea of how people should behave, it's unrealistic of human behavior. And so in the last 50 years, we've learned a lot more about what are the constraints that guide people's decisions. So the guiding principle of bounded rationality is that people seek to behave rationally, but are constrained by limited knowledge and cognitive capacity. Now, we've bandied about the idea of the cognitive load. But basically, it boils down to people may generate or consider, when they're making a decision, a limited set of options because they're constrained by such problems as memory, attention, motivation, their physiology, their emotional state at the time. And people also may incorrectly estimate probability distributions or use different strategies to estimate options, uncertainties. So if you're thinking about what's the utility of an option, rational agent theory would suggest that you look at the utility and the probability of acquiring it. And people have a hard time calculating probability as well. But the most important point here is that it implies that people are often systematically irrational. Moreover, it leads, over the last 50 years, research has pointed out a simple but profound fact, and that the judgments and decisions people make are not about extensional states or objective states of the world. They're more about our mental representations of those states at the time of judgment. And so the construal processes that we engage in context profoundly influence survey responses, judgments, decisions, language, perception, and social life. And as an example, I'm going to show you two surveys in which Americans are asked to estimate how much television they watched each week. In version A, people are given the options of how many hours are you going to watch? Do you watch 1 to 4, 5 to 8, 9 to 12, 13 to 16, 17 to 20, more than 20? And in version B, they're given a slightly different scale, so 1 to 2, 3 to 4, 5 to 6, 7 to 8, 9 to 10, and more than 10. And so most people don't have any clue about how much television they watch, but they figure, well, I probably don't watch as much as the most, the largest end of the scale, but I'm kind of in the middle. So when you give people these two skills, in the first example, people say, I watch about 9 to 12 hours of television a day. In the other one, they say, I watch about 5 to 6 hours of television a week. And so people don't really have an idea of their own behavior when they're making these estimates and when they're giving you survey responses. They're inferring a lot of information from the scale that you're providing them with. In the first case, they're saying, well, 20 hours is sort of on the high end, but 12 to 13 is average, so watch a little less than the average person. In the bottom, they're thinking, well, 10 is pretty high, so I probably watch about 5 to 6. As another example, you think most people should have an idea of how happy they are in life and what is most important to them. But if you ask them in one version, how happy are you, and then how many dates did you have last week, the correlation between happiness and dating is about 0.12. In other words, dating explains about 1% of the variance in their happiness response. Whereas if you ask them how many dates did you have last week, and then how happy are you, the correlation is about 0.66. So how many dates they had last week explains about 44% of their happiness reports. So in other words, people are inferring from the questions that you're asking what are important attributes and how they should respond, or what should they value, or you're making certain aspects of their life more salient to them, and they're basing their judgments on those salient features. As an example of sort of basic societal implications, here are the rate of organ, the number of people who consent to engage in organ donation based on the country's nationwide default. So as you can see, the countries in yellow, such as Denmark, Netherlands, United Kingdom, and Germany, you have to opt in order to be an organ donor. Whereas in the countries in blue, such as Austria, Belgium, France, Hungary, Poland, Portugal, and Sweden, you have to opt out. And so effectively, you get about 90% or higher rates of organ donation consent when the default policy is to opt in. Whereas you get about, if you're lucky, 27% if the option is to opt in, right? So setting defaults is a very powerful way of guiding human behavior. We talked a little bit about ideas where you encrypt with zero click, or setting the basic automatic setups of your operating systems to be the most secure as possible, and giving people the option to opt out is better in terms of it would lead to a more secure machine or system. So just to give you an idea of some of my own research, I've been looking at interesting effects of constraints of memory on judgment. So, for example, when you think about some kind of category of experience, people don't think about the most typical instances, they think about the most extreme. So if you're thinking about how much you'll enjoy your visit to the dentist next time, you're probably not thinking about all the routine cleanings you undergo, but perhaps one of the more extreme, more painful experiences. And to illustrate how this can influence judgment, when I was a graduate student here in Cambridge, I went to Fenway Park, and I asked Red Sox fans as they were entering the park to recall and briefly describe a game they saw when the Red Sox won. Some participants were asked in a free recall condition to recall any one game the Sox won. People in a biased recall condition were asked to recall the best game the Sox won. People in no recall condition did not recall a game. And then I simply asked them to forecast their enjoyment of the game they're about to see. So how much do you think you'll enjoy the game you're about to see? And finally asked them to rate the game they recalled. And so what I found was that people were asked to recall any one game they could recall when the Sox won tended to recall an instance as good as people explicitly asked to recall the best. So in other words, when you think about how much you're going to enjoy a baseball game or how bad a flight will be, you don't think about sort of the typical flight or the typical baseball game. You think about your favorite or the worst flight that you ever experienced. And as you can see, these influence their predictions, as only people in the biased recall condition corrected for the extremity of their judgment, right? So people who are asked to recall any single instance tend to think of the most extreme and use that as a basis for the judgment, unless they're explicitly asked to recall the most extreme instance. And here they're correcting for their judgment. As you can see, people in no recall condition look much like people in the free recall condition. Other kinds of constraints on judgment are constraints of attention and motivation. So for example, if I told you, you're going to eat one of these two foods for lunch today, and then I told you, well, you're going to eat the potato chips, you can think about how potato chips, sort of features of these two foods on a number of dimensions. But you're going to be constrained by sort of your attention and motivation in terms of the number of features you consider. So you can think about how potato chips are relatively better than sardines, or you can think about how much you like potato chips in general, right? And so which kinds of these kinds of comparisons we engage in depends much on sort of what kinds of, how motivated we are to look further than sort of base features. So to illustrate this point, I had people in South Station in Boston, which some of you may have visited. We gave them scratch cards. And so what people were asked to do was scratch off one side of the card, and they would reveal an amount of money that they would win. And then they would scratch the other side to see the amount of money they could have won instead. And so the idea was, are people who receive the superior amount or the inferior amount, who's sensitive to relative comparisons and who's sensitive to absolute comparisons? You think that people who win the superior amount should probably be more sensitive to the relative comparison, whereas if you win something more worse off, then you should be more sensitive to both the relative and the absolute comparison, because you have to justify that you want something good. As you can see, when people win the superior amount of money, whether it's $7, $5, or $3 in this case, people are equally happy. So when you get the better amount here, in this case, people are just making the relative comparison. But when the inferior amount, people are sensitive to the size of the amount they want. So people are happier with $5 and $3 than $1. And so here you can see that people are only when people are motivated to engage in further steps of information processing do they do so. And negative feedback is one way of giving them that motivation. So just in summary, people tend to often endorse the rational agent view or the normative view of behavior upon reflection. When you ask people, what should you have done? They're like, oh yeah, I should have behaved more rationally. But our processing of information, which can be effortless, automatic, intuitive, and heuristic, is often not privy to or governed by these kinds of normative requirements. Instead, these kinds of constraints of memory, attention, motivation, framing, sensitivities, and insensitivities lead to predictable irrationality and error. And so if you're interested in this kind of research, there's an excellent jumping point. Daniel Kahneman has an article in American Psychologist called Mapping Bound Irrationality, and I'd encourage you to read it as a point to begin. Thanks.
Thank you, Perry. The next speaker, and the last speaker in the panel, is also a CMU, the Herbert Simon Professor of Psychology and Economics, George Lowenstein, is a leader in the field of behavior economics and one of the founders of the field of neuroeconomics. George.
Thank you, George. Thanks to all the participants on this panel. We do have some time, around half an hour for questions, so we'll start with that.
So, I think this is for George, but maybe it isn't. I wonder if there's a, with respect to attitudes toward privacy, if there's not a generation gap, with the current group of college students maybe being at the leading edge. You know, these are kids who grew up in an internet era who have a very different idea of an online presence, who are routinely disclosing far more about their activities than the rest of us were at that age. And I wonder if, you know, that's shaped people's attitudes toward privacy. I taught a seminar last semester on technology and policy in which the students were asked to write every week often controversial essays. So we took some care, which they would blog about, so we took some care to keep the blog limited to the class, to keep it off of Google and the internet at large, because we didn't want to hold them responsible for the rest of their lives for some wild idea they had while in college. Well, the students were quite aggressive in saying that they really didn't care about this, that they were very happy to have everything they write be indexed on Google in perpetuity, and all of this nonsense that we were creating to protect their privacy was really unnecessary. You know, hopefully by the end of the course that attitude changed a little bit, but I was really surprised at how uniform the lack of a sensitivity to privacy was, and I don't remember feeling that way at that age. Is that,
I think you could argue that there are two countervailing factors. One is that they grew up in an age where there's much more divulgence of information, for example, MySpace and so on. But on the other hand, they're used to these technologies. And we, the older generation, is used to a different set of technologies. So I think the older generation is vulnerable because we're less savvy about exactly these issues of the changing, the different cues that the new media provide. And so we're much less likely to appreciate that internet is permanent. So I think you could argue that it could go either way.
Thank you, Angela. Very quick response to that. I think there's also the fact that kids generally are very open about things. You ask a 10-year-old almost anything, unless it's something which they regard as really heinous, then they will probably tell it to you. Whereas you ask a 14-year-old something, and they'll be saying, well, why do you want to know? To some extent. George, again, I may bring some of this up on the catalogs this afternoon, but I was struck by the link to some of the things you were saying with my research on the concept of information privacy in Japan, and the concept there of the Uchi Soto Tanin distinctions between people. Uchi is those who are close to you, Soto is those with whom you have regular contact, but who are not close to you. And this is a very grave simplification of the concept. And Tanin is those with whom you have no regular contact. So you might have some connection, like filling in an online survey, but you have no ongoing connection with them. And my research in Japan shows that the Soto group is the one that they care about. That's the one that people actually worry about. And I think that some of the results you're getting are showing that to most people, anything you fill in on the internet is regarded as Tanin. I actually think that this model is actually quite universal. Just that the Japanese have a way of showing it. It's embedded in their linguistics. But I think it's actually very common to many cultures. Tanin is those with whom you have very little contact. It's the outsider, it's the unknown. And Uchi is the inside, and Soto is the group which you are not your friends, they're not your close group, they're people with whom you have regular contact. No, Tanin is the internet, I think. It's the faceless other. Whereas Soto is when you know who it is, when you know it's your professor, when you know it's your bank, when you know it's your employer. The people with whom you don't have a close, friendly relationship, you don't have, in the concept I will be talking about definitely, is confidence. You don't have confidence that they will treat what you tell them in confidence necessarily. Whereas Tanin, well, it won't come back on me because it's this mass of data and who's going to tie it back to it.
Right. But I think that one of the impacts of the internet, and going back to this issue of the different generations, might have is to kind of mix up these categories. And I know that from talking to my children and students, they often talk about their friends, and they use it to the concept of friend in a very different sense. And I always wonder, is it that they have a different definition of what a friend is, so that for them, somebody who they're connected to on MySpace, whether they really feel that they're a friend, or is it that they have a different definition of friends? So they know that this is not my friend, but I'm using the term friend differently.
Probably some of those sites use the word friend in a well-defined way, so that screws that up. So okay. It might be the formal definition on the social site is a friend.
But I think that's a really important question. might well have ramifications for the categorization of people and how it responds to them.
I have the least of the people who raised their hands, so Angela, who's next?
I was looking for a benefit of disclosure in the experiments.
A benefit of?
What would be the benefit of disclosure?
I think that people, this is a follow-up interest of ours, particularly of Leslie's, but I think there's a real human need for people to divulge information. I mean, people look at going back to the musical Fame, but everyone's blogging now, people are writing memoirs, people,
there seems to be just an incredible human desire to be known. And I think
but you're not going to be known by ticking some boxes in the moment of the survey. I mean, we've got models in HCI of how people reason about privacy, and they're very clearly saying that what people do is they assess the risks against the benefits, and if there's no benefit, so basically you might disclose some very, very sensitive information to a medical professional because you don't.
Yeah, I mean, in a lot of these cases, you could say logically, you're not going to be known as a result of this. But people don't make such fine distinctions. When somebody asks you a personal question and you divulge that you smoke pot or something, I'm a cool person, I smoke pot, then it feels it's satisfying. It feels like, someone knows how cool I am, even if it's just a survey.
We've actually had some quite interesting in-depth studies looking at the experience, and they show that actually, first of all, there is that model that the researcher and analyst in the early 2000s says there is a process model. So the disclosure also very much depends on that person's previous experience of disclosing things and whether they experience positive consequences. So I think the whole thing is a little bit more complex. If you're blogging, most people blog because they hope they can be picked up and be given, a TV spot, or they might get a column in a newspaper,
The whole thing is a lot more complex. But, in these experiments, we're trying to abstract some very narrow, specific elements of reality.
That would be my usual concern. It's like whether you can do that and still end up to affect the most part.
But it seems like one of the important points to draw too is that people don't naturally think of privacy. It's not the thing that comes to mind. And only when you make privacy salient do they consider, should I disclose the information or not? I mean, people don't think about putting drunken photos of themselves on their Facebook accounts or their MySpace accounts unless they're thinking about, is my employer going to have access to this, or if they're prompted, do you want this to be published on your page to be published on Google? They don't think about that unless they're prompted.
An environment where they can read the cues and where they have developed norms that govern their behavior, right? If you know that other people can see you, you behave in a different way than if you don't think anybody else is seeing cues. And we just don't have that equivalent in the electronic world. But as more and more things get, more and more negative stories get reported as a result of disclosing things on Facebook, people adapt their behavior. I mean, nobody in their right mind now puts their Facebook into any social network. I mean, the data quality of the social network sites is very,
very
high.
There's thousands of people who put their date of birth in there, and Alexander has data on this. Thousands of people put their date of birth and hometown on their Facebook accounts.
Why not?
There's
very good reasons
not to.
Okay, so I cannot just before I answer my question, comment on the profound irony of Angela arguing with George that there needs to be a perceived benefit in a transaction. that was just too perfect. And also what I say, I don't know how many of you have read Lulin's works on trust, where he specifically talks about trust not just as a simplifying mechanism, but also as a transactional need. But actually, why I raised my hand in the queue, we were talking about generational issues, and I wanted to say one of the things I found in generational issues is that older people don't lie. Because they conceive of it as lying. If they go to Facebook and they join Facebook, why would they lie? Because lying is a bad thing. Whereas if you're, I have a disproportionate number of junior high school friends due to being a parent, or at least I know them, they all lie. They have like little notebooks and files of all their identities that they keep. And I think that your experiment was particularly good because you controlled for that, right? You didn't say, and the general population says 30% of them smoke pot, whatever you said, in this experiment. And I think that not only is it a generational issue, it's an experimental design issue.
actually one of these theorems that we ran, we did give them that information. But we rigged it. And so we tell people what other people, we give people false information about how many other people answer the question. And that also affects people. People are much more willing to disclose information when they think that other people have disclosed the information.
Or is it just more normative? They think it's more normal.
No, I think in some cases we didn't tell them what the response
was. In one condition, we manipulated the amount of people admitting to a certain behavior. In another, we manipulated the number of people who just skipped the question, who refused to answer the question. And then they didn't impact missionaries. The next thing is just fine.
I think all the sociological research suggests that the word privacy or privacy, which we're using, has kind of been a bit more nuanced when we're talking about it online as opposed to offline. I think the danger of using the same concept to capture two different human interactions and two different experiences. Privacy, as it emerges historically and in society, is very much about shielding yourself to find intimate space from the outside world, from the market, all of harsh reality. It's about creating a condition where you're free from losing face, from being embarrassed, from the usual sort of stigma of everyday life. And therefore, it is something that you kind of construct around you in terms of certain reactions, whereas privacy on the internet is experienced very, very differently on the internet. Especially the younger generations are not afraid of losing face in the conventional sense. They are, but in a very, very, very different kind of a way. Their sense of intimacy and the desire for intimacy is actually subverted by the fact that all the research suggests that what they really are trying to do is to, in a sense, subvert privacy by sending out a signal, I'm a real group. In fact, all the research suggests that the single most important message that comes across from the younger generation, I'm available, I'm here, sort of contact me, and all the rest of that. And I think in that sense, the meaning of privacy and the meaning of divulging information acquires a very different kind of quality to it. And I would be very reluctant to use privacy as an operational concept in anything like the same way when we're talking about the online experience. And I think we just need to reflect on that a bit.
That's an interesting point, but the material consequences of revealing information are consistent across the generations. And that, in a way, that I think that's our point. But the keys can vary as a function of context, and that also varies as a function of generation. But the material consequences are pretty consistent.
Nicholas,
which does that mean?
Like, for example, the prospect of being kicked out of school if you are discovered to have cheated, or if you cheat on your taxes, the consequences of divulging personal behaviors are similar regardless of your age.
The criminal ones.
Yeah.
I think you need to be clear about that.
Okay.
I've got a question for Tom, but first of all, thanks for what you just said about privacy. Years ago, I did some experiments in which I gave monkeys who lived in an open colony where they could watch by everybody else than gone the chance to work, to be alone, to be out of sight. And they would work very hard to get out of sight. The question is, what would they do when they were out of sight? Well, they indulge in all sorts of, or they get to private papers. They do things which they would have been embarrassed to do if they were being watched. They would pick their noses, stand on their heads, make faces, and so on. And it's clear that private space is, in fact, a space which we value because we're unobserved. And I think that sense, it's not what Frank was talking about, that's not the same kind of privacy that exactly we're talking about on the internet. It's interesting enough, I gave other monkeys the chance to observe monkeys by video link, who we thought they were in private. And that turned out to be the most exciting thing I could offer. But to come to the question of time, I think this experiment's very interesting and it's useful. I mean, can see why he wants to look at individual differences. I think my worry is that his measures are working against him. The problem is that empathizers, if such exist, are going to be people who are interested in whether they're being fished or not, because they're going to be interested in their social relationships with other people. While systemizers who are not so interested in how they stand in relation to other people or what other people are doing are not going to be so interested in it. So you've got the two factors working against each other, possibly the interest in the local details of the web page and against the internet, which is not going to correlate, but actually being interested in whether or not you're being fished. But I wanted to say that not many people accept this distinction between sympathizers and empathizers. Sundar and Kern's dimensions have been very broadly challenged, and it's not felt generally to be a useful way of categorizing the way people think, or certainly what their brains are like. But a measure related to it is global thinking as against local. Seeing things globally against being interested in the details, and that does stand up. It's parallel to the system dimension. That stands up very widely in a lot of different measures. And it turns out to be very much a cultural phenomenon as well as possibly a genetic phenomenon. Japanese, for example, are universally far towards the global level of information processing compared to Westerners. And you get Japanese men. Scientists, engineers, for example, turn out to be to the right of female nurses in Scotland in terms of how the Japanese men are interested in the whole picture and women too. In Scotland, everybody's much more interested in the local picture and men to a greater degree. It's such a big effect, and it comes out in. Very interesting, it comes out even in just simple psychophysics. So we ask people to respond to as an illusion, Ebbinghaus illusion, where you have circles surrounded by other circles. And, if you surround circles by small circles, it looks bigger than the one, surrounded by the big ones, small circles are a bit smaller. The big individual differences in this, Japanese universally showed less, showed greater illusion. Than Westerners do, as men show, women show greater illusion than men do. I think it's such an interesting dimension of human cognition that suggests that if you're right, that being a local processor makes you more likely to detect a fishing site and to notice what the URLs are, we might find that there are going to be huge cultural differences in the ability to detect these things. For example, the Japanese.
Yeah, so I'm certainly not qualified to defend Simon Gerard-Cohen's thesis, but what we're definitely seeing that there is heterogeneity in the responses that people are having to these security indicators. So perhaps the thesis isn't necessarily the absolute 100% correct distinction. Maybe it's what you suggest that I'd like to follow up on that. But to go back to the first thing you said, which is that there could be something, it could be that people who are empathizers are more likely to fall for phishing in particular than systemizers. I mean, I'm a little skeptical that phishing is primarily, right now, in fact, targets people's online banking. And people of all types do online banking. People of all types go to Amazon, this sort of thing. And so I think that phishing affects all types of people. But then the other point is that this is really about designing security indicators more broadly, not just about warnings against phishing and detecting phishing attacks. It's about designing security indicators which people with different characteristics can react to. So it's not just about phishing.
Well, the original idea for that work came from some ladies in Oregon at Gender HCI, and their complaint is that programming languages are designed by boy geeks for boy geeks, and they're unnecessarily difficult for girls to use. There have been a number of respectable publications in this field, and having come across this, I thought, well, hey, that rings very true for security mechanisms as well. I bet the security mechanisms being designed by geeks for geeks discriminate against women.
is there some quick and cheerful experiment that we could do to check whether this is merit? Now, as it happened, we used the type S for us to type E tests, rather than just getting the experimental subjects to tick a box saying a boy or a girl. But the latter approach we've also worked out. And, you know, it opens up the field to questions about how things should be designed and tested in the future.
Yes, but I think the male-female dimension is going to be absolutely in the cultural difference.
Yuri Bruce and Ralph next to the least of Yuri. Bruce?
I just have something which I recommend reading. I think one of the best things written, it's not scholarly, but it's really very interesting, on the generation gap of privacy, written by a reporter from New York Magazine. And if you just go into Google and type Say Everything, which is the title of the article, New York Magazine, you'll get it. And I think the author does a really good job of explaining young people and their relationship with privacy. And it's not as obvious as we think. Very good about privacy, but it's just different. So I'd recommend that as reading people interested in that.
You should look at the geography of thought and additional work by Nisbet, which discusses the Eastern versus Western thought. And he's got a number of experiments that say Eastern brains look at poles and Westerners take things apart. Has lovely hypotheses about our Greek trader, not to put too fine a point on it, pirate ancestry, that forced you to look at lots of different views, whereas the Middle Kingdom in China is much more of a holistic view. Look up Nisbet's work, and you'll find that it's very similar to your systemizers versus empathizers. And later stuff that he's done actually show how you perceive things, but with fMRI, differently in culture. I'd like to also mention, I ran across, and I don't have the reference right now, to someone who did a series of elaborated prisoner game experiments to get trust, and then measured blood components. And he found that oxytocin had a dose-related relationship to the amount of trust that you put the money back into this prisoner game thing. Except for the more oxytocin, the more trust you had. Except for one group of people, which is about 2 or 3% of the population, had huge oxytocin levels in their blood system, and they were bastards. That was his term. They would always, there was no trust, and they would always pull the rug out from under you. So there are actual biological bases for people who are really rough.
Yeah, well, I would say that what they test we have is a proxy.
Yeah.
So and in some very common just looking at fMRI and trying to come up with more physiological.
The point is that there may be a cultural implication to those two classes.
Oh, I.
I'd Laurie, Richard, and Paul. Thanks, Laurie.
So, getting back to systemizers and empathizers, the big concern I have is that I think that there could be a lot of other factors, and that the systemizer and empathizer may not, in fact, actually be the main and important factor that's going on here. It seems like technical major or not might be a factor, whether or not they knew about fishing. I mean, we've done studies that have found that people who can define fishing are better at identifying fishing places. Can't define fishing. So those kind of factors seem like they're really important to look at before you worry about systemizers and empathizers.
I agree. I agree to a certain extent. I think that systemizers and empathizers is certainly only as part of the explanation at best. As you can see from the scatterplot, it's kind of all over the place, but the trend is still there.
Right, but there may be a correlation between technical major and being a systemizer.
Yes, I need to test for that properly.
That would be the first thing I would have tested for. Is it mean you have that data, so you can test that. I suspect there's a correlation. I suspect there's also a correlation between being a systemizer and reading technical publications for fun.
Oh, of course there are, but does that invalidate the results anymore. I mean, it's a different way of seeing the same options. So that people are different, and the outcome and response and vision are different.
Well, so I don't know. So the other thing with Ross's comment that the purpose of doing this was to find out whether security tools are better designed for men than for women, which I think is a very good thing to look for, but I don't think this experiment actually did anything along those lines because you didn't actually test the response to a security tool. So, for example, we did a study of anti-phishing film, the video game that showed you. We had about 4,000 people, random people on the internet, not students, come and play it. We found that we did a pretest and a post-test. Women did not score as well on the pretest as men did. Okay? When they played the game, everybody improved by playing the game. The absolute increase was about the same for men and women. Women ended up worse off than men at the end because they started off worse off, but they all increased by the same amount. That tests the ability of a tool to help men and women, given how where they're coming in.
Yeah, I just wonder whether tech, since a conference on security, that led us to enshrine privacy more than we should. Clearly, lots of people get significant benefits from revealing information. I've revealed information about myself to 20 people here. And my guess is, if I asked George to figure out why that might have worked against me, he'd come up with some good reason, but that was the need for establishing relationships, trust, or whatever else it might be. There have been thousands of experiments and surveys that I know of. I've never heard of anybody getting kicked out of college because they revealed on a survey to some professor that they had in fact cheated on a test. There may have been such a person, but I've never heard of such a person. And I'm just wondering, also including George's final goal for regulation. One, it's not obvious to me, particularly given your study, which is fascinating, which way regulation would push things. In other words, regulation one might just give me reassurance about the national regulatory regime for information disclosure on the internet. That might lead you to disclose a lot more than they otherwise would. The second question is, it's not clear whether that's good or bad. It's not obvious to me in the world. When we have a session where people are talking a lot about privacy and security and phishing expeditions, then you tend to think that revealing information is a terrible thing. And I know Alessandro is going to tell us how we figure out our social security numbers by looking at whether we have a mustache or not. But that doesn't happen very often. So I'm just wondering, looking at it as a commonness on a cost-benefit basis, are people revealing too little or are they revealing too much?
I think you can't ask the question of whether people are revealing too little or too much, because we don't know exactly what the costs and benefits are for each of the individuals in our study. But what we can say is, if we manipulate a factor that is agreed upon, now that's not might be controversial, but is agreed upon to be a non-normative factor that should not influence people's privacy, and people's revelation of information does respond to that factor, or even worse, if we reveal a factor that logically that factor should be, let's say, positively correlated with costs or negatively correlated with benefits, but people respond in exactly the opposite fashion, then I would say we don't know that any individual in our study is over-revealing or under-revealing, but people on both sides, in both conditions, can't be revealing correctly. And so that's exactly why we do these studies in this fashion. Now you might be able to come up with some kind of normative justification for our factors having the effect that they do, which would undermine that argument. But I think we can, my own view is that we can make the argument that not everyone is revealing properly. We don't know who's making a mistake.
I agree with you. I think it's remarkable that that doesn't mean necessarily over-revealing or that regulation pushes the right direction.
That's right. And so until we know whether people are making a mistake in one direction or the other, it would be premature to regulate. Except what you might do is you might try to come up with regulation that helps to calibrate people that helped to drive people to seek more privacy in situations where more privacy is called for and less privacy in situations where less privacy is called for. That's, to me, that seems pretty likely to be beneficial.
And pretty unlikely to be realized.
So
I have 8 more people who listed down for questions, and 3 minutes already long in the session. This is the sign of a fun session. Hopefully we can use the time during the break for offline discussion. There is another session on privacy after lunch, in which I hope this discussion will be continued. So in the meanwhile, to allow all of you to get some coffee at the end. So I would like to thank the panelists.